2015. Okay, so we'll start with the three times the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, so today we will be taking the suttas that I actually had intended for last week. See, this is sutta number 144. Okay, and this is a bit of a controversial sutta, as we'll see. So this is called the Channovada Sutta, the sutta of, here it's translated advice to Channa, but as I've explained, uvada has a stronger meaning than advice. It's something like an exhortation. Okay, so the sutta, it's set at a time when the Buddha is living in the bamboo grove, but the main event of the sutta doesn't involve the Buddha, but a group of monks with the Venerable Sariputta, the Venerable Mahachunda. Both of those are well-known, highly revered, great disciples of the Buddha. And then there's another monk named Channa, and the three of them are living on the mountain called Vulture's Peak. Okay, and then the sutta tells us that on this occasion, the Venerable Channa was afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill. This is a stock expression used everywhere in the suttas to describe somebody who's seriously ill. Okay, so then the text tells us that in the evening, the Venerable Sariputta emerged from meditation and he went to the Venerable Mahachunda and he said, "Let us go to the Venerable Channa and ask about his illness." And so the two of them go off to meet the Venerable Channa. Okay, so after when they meet, then Sariputta asks the Venerable Channa, he says, again, this is the stock expression, when others are meeting a sick person, they say, "I hope you are getting well, I hope you are comfortable, I hope your pains are subsiding and not increasing," and their subsiding, not their increase, is apparent. Okay, but here Channa replies in exactly the same words, or almost the same words that we came across in the previous sutta, the discourse to Anathapindika, when Anathapindika was very ill. Okay, so Channa says that, "Friend Sariputta, I'm not getting well, I'm not feeling comfortable, my pains are increasing, not subsiding." Then he goes on to describe his condition. To get the actual text, we have to turn back to Sutta 43, section number 4, that it's just as if a strong man were splitting my head open with a sharp sword, just as if a strong man were pulling a tough leather strap around my head, just as if a skilled butcher were carving up an ox's belly with a sharp butcher's knife. But just as if two strong men were to grab hold of a weaker man by both arms and roast him over a pit of hot coals. So I am not getting well. I am not comfortable. My pains are increasing, not subsiding. But then he adds something else that Anathapindika didn't say. He says, I shall use the knife, friend Sariputta. I have no desire to live. And when he says, I will use the knife, this doesn't mean that he's going to use the knife to cut up an apple or a peach, but it means that he's going to use the knife on himself. In other words, I'm going to take my own life. Okay, so when he says this, then Sariputta, Venerable Sariputta, protests. And he says, please, Venerable Channa, don't think of using the knife. Please continue to live on. We want you to live on. If you lack suitable food, I will ensure that you get suitable food. If you lack suitable medicines, I'll arrange to get suitable medicines for you. If you lack an attendant, somebody to constantly take care of you, I'll arrange to get if you lack a proper attendant, I will attend on you. I myself will attend on you. And then again he says, please don't think of using the knife. We want you to live. Okay, but then Channa remains, at least apparently he remains firm in his decision. So he answers Sariputta's petition by saying that it's not that I lack suitable food, I have suitable food. It's not that I lack medicine, I've taken so many medicines and none of them are working. It's not that I lack a proper attendant. Okay, then he says, and I'm not so happy with this translation. He says, let me translate the way I would do it now. I think this with love comes from Venerable Nyanaboli. But I looked at the actual Pali text, and it uses the expression manapena, which means agreeable or in an agreeable way. So he says, rather, friend Sariputta, the teacher, that's the Buddha, has long been worshipped or venerated by me in an agreeable way, not in a disagreeable way. It is proper for a disciple to venerate or to serve the teacher in an agreeable way, not in a disagreeable way. And then he adds a statement. He says, friend Sariputta, remember that the Bhikkhu Channa will use the knife blamelessly. There's a note here. Let's just read the note. Okay, so the note says that by making this statement, he is implicitly claiming arahatship. And that will become clear later in paragraph 13. Okay, now what's interesting is that, okay, this is the Pali version of the sutta, but I checked my friend Venerable Analeo's notes, comparative notes on comparing the Chinese version with the Pali version. In the Chinese version, Channa doesn't make that statement, but rather he says that he can no longer endure the pain and affliction of his illness, that the pain and affliction of his illness are just overpowering. Okay, but let us just take the Pali version as the one that we'll be discussing. So when he says that he'll use the knife blamelessly, in the light of what the Buddha is going to say later, this means or implies that he's claiming, it implies that he's attained arhatship. And so he's using the knife for taking his own life as an arahat. Okay, now Sariputta says, I'm going to ask you certain questions. So it seems that Sariputta here wants to test Channa to see whether he has actually attained arhatship. And there's something a little puzzling in the question that I'll bring up. So he says, I will ask the Venerable Channa certain questions if you wouldn't find it a burden to reply. Okay, so then Channa says, you may ask, and then when I've heard your questions, then I'll see whether I can answer them. Okay, so then Sariputta says, friend Channa, do you regard the I consciousness, and things cognizable by the mind through I consciousness thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. And the same question is repeated for each of the other sense bases. Do you regard the ear, nose, tongue, body, the mind consciousness, and things cognizable by the mind through mind consciousness thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself. Okay, then Channa replies, I regard the I consciousness and things cognizable through I consciousness, that is visible forms, thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. I regard the ear, nose, tongue, body, mind consciousness, and dhammas, that is mental phenomena, cognizable through mind consciousness, thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Okay, from the questions and Channa's answers to these questions, what if Channa's questions are really truthful and correct, what can we infer about Channa? Speak up, please. Excuse me? Exactly. Or that he's at least a stream enterer. But you might be inclined, you know, to see this, you might be inclined to draw the inference that he's an arhat. But it's not necessarily the case, because this is what is seen by any of the noble disciples, starting from the level of stream enterer. So there's a number of suttas, several suttas that occur in the Sangyutta Nikaya. I think that's in chapter 22. It's somewhere around, I'm sure that I had made some notes and now I can't find them. Exactly where those suttas are. I think it's around Sutta, somewhere in the 100s in chapter 22, where the question is raised, what is the defining mark of a stream enterer? And it's one who is seen, in this case, it's the five aggregates, as being not I, not mine, not I, not myself. And then the next sutta says, what is the defining mark of the arahat? It's one who, having seen the five aggregates as being not mine, not I, not myself, his mind is liberated from the asavas through non-clinging. And so this is what I find is a bit strange, that if they were testing to see definitely whether he was an arahat, then the question should have been phrased in a way that, you know, focused in on one of the defining characteristics of an arhat. But in any case, at this point, the questions are testing whether he is at any level from stream enterer up. So this would be especially, this would be like the defining characteristic of what is called the seka. The seka is the one in higher training and generally comprises those at the first three stages of realization. Stream enterer, once returning, non-returning. Okay, so then Sariputta continues with the question, and he says, what have you seen and what have you directly known? This is abhinyaya. In the eye consciousness and in things cognizable through eye consciousness. And then continuing, what have you known in the ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, and so forth, that you regard them thus? This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. So now he's asking about the content of that realization, by reason of which he's able to affirm the non-self nature of the six sense bases, their objects, and their corresponding types of consciousness. And then the Venerable Channa replies, friend Sariputta, it is through seeing and directly knowing cessation in the eye consciousness, etc., that I regard them thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And then the same is repeated for the other five sense bases. And so the essential point here is that he's saying that it is knowing cessation. And sort of this is, you could say, situating his explanation or his claim within the framework of the Four Noble Truths. Because what is the content of a stream enterer's realization of the Four Noble Truths is the realization of the Third Noble Truth, the direct seeing of the cessation of dukkha, which is actually the cessation of all conditioned phenomena. And so when it's said that the stream enterer is one who has understood as they really are the Four Noble Truths, what makes that understanding complete? It's not the understanding of dukkha, its origin, or the path, but it's the direct experience or realization of nibbana, which is the cessation of dukkha. And so it's with the realization, the direct seeing of nibbana, that the fetter of sakkaya ditti, the view of self, is eradicated, cut off. And when that fetter of the view of self is eradicated, then one sees and understands that the five aggregates or the six sense bases and their objects are all not mine, not I, not myself. Okay, so far, you know, from what we can deduce, you know, setting these statements within the broader framework of the teaching, that even though Channa said, I'm going to use the knife blamelessly, implying that he's an arhat, but if his claim is genuine or his answers to Sariputta's questions are genuine and correct and accurate or truthful, then at most we could infer that he is a seka. He might be an arhat, but the answers themselves do not set forth a claim to arhatship. Okay, so when this was said, then the Venerable Mahachunda, the other monk who is with Sariputta, then makes a statement to the Venerable Channa. He says, "Therefore, friend Channa, this instruction of the Blessed Ones is to be constantly given attention." And according to the commentary, the Venerable Mahachunda said this because he was convinced that Chunda was still a, we call a putujana, that is a worldling, an unenlightened person. In any case, it seems that Mahachunda had the idea, this is my understanding, that Mahachunda had the idea that the Venerable Channa was definitely going to go ahead and to use the knife to take his life. And so he gave him this advice, the way I would understand it, as something to be borne in mind as he goes into the death process, so that he's able to, by keeping the mind focused upon this, then he wouldn't give rise to fear and agitation when entering upon the death process, and could even attain arhatship in the course of the death process. So it seems, I'm not sure that I would agree that Mahachunda necessarily thought that Channa was a worldling, but he might have thought from the answers that he's still, that he might be a noble one, but not yet an arhat. So he's giving this him this advice with the understanding that perhaps if Channa bears this advice, this statement in mind while he's entered the death process, then he could achieve liberation before death takes place. So the statement is that, I'll just reverse the wording a little bit to bring out the sense better. For one who is dependent, there is wavering, chelitang, movement, kind of vacillation, even agitation. And by dependent is usually meant, in this case, nisitasa. The word nisita implies either relying upon, being dependent upon craving, or upon views. But if Channa was really a stream enterer or higher, then they wouldn't be relying upon or depending upon views because he's overcome wrong views, but there will still be some tendency towards craving. Okay, so for one who is dependent, the sense of who still has some trace of craving left, there is this agitation. In one who is independent, who is freed from that dependency on craving, there is no wavering, no fluctuation, no agitation. Okay, when there is no agitation, then there is tranquility, pasuddhi, calmness. When there is no tranquility, I'm sorry, when there is tranquility, again, I don't like this, the rendering here. There is no, here the rendering is, there is no bias, but the Pali word is actually nati, which means literally it's bending. The word nutti is actually related to the word namo. When we do homage to the Buddha, we say namo tassa bhagavato. So namo is sort of bending in as an act of homage. But nutti here, in this passage, it's not homage, but it's bending or inclination. And I think the idea here is a bending in the sense of inclining towards a new existence, towards going on to a rebirth, or a bending towards a particular destiny of rebirth. Okay, so when there is tranquility, and this would be probably the perfect tranquility of arhatship, then there is no bending or inclination. When there is no bending, there is no coming and going. This is coming into a new existence by way of birth or conception, and going, that's departing from that existence by way of death. In other words, there's no more birth and death. And when there is no coming and going, there is no passing away and reappearing or re-arising. This is actually just saying almost the same thing, just inverting the two stages. Okay, when there is no passing away and reappearing or re-arising, there is no here, that is, no more coming into this world, nor anything beyond, that is, passing by way of rebirth into some other realm of existence, some other world, nor anything in between. And interestingly, this little phrase here, and it, nor in between, seems to me to be suggesting that there is some state of passage between one existence and another existence. So this can be taken as the basis for an idea that raised storms of controversy among the early Buddhist schools. To me, it seems like something that generates more heat than light. The question whether there is an intermediate stage between existences. You know, the orthodox position of the Theravadan commentaries, based on a few rather obscure passages in the Abhidhamma, is no intermediate stage. Death is followed instantaneously by a new birth. I think it was the Savastivada school and a few other schools aligned with the Savastivadins, based on passages like this, said that this is sort of proof or evidence that there is an intermediate stage. My own conviction, heretical conviction, based on some other passages, is that there is an intermediate stage, and not based only on textual passages, but also accounts that I've read of people who have recollections of their previous life and of what took place at death before their birth into that existence. Okay, so here Mahachunda is saying, when there is no passing away and re-arising, then there is no here that's coming back into this world, nor beyond that is passing by way of rebirth into some other world, nor anything in between. This is the end of dukkha. Eso va dukkha santo. Antang, I think it is. So this is the end of dukkha. In other words, this is the attainment of final nibbana. Okay, so now the text continues that when the Venerable Sariputta and the Venerable Mahachunda had exhorted the Venerable Channa thus, then they rose from their seats and went away. It seems a little strange to me that, you know, I would think in a situation where there are three monks living together and one of them says, I'm going to use the knife, I'm going to take my life, that one of them would be set up as a constant guard, you know, to constantly being present to console the monk, to encourage him when he's feeling dejected, and if there are any indications that he's going to use the knife to try to stop him. But anyway, the text tells us that Sariputta and the Venerable Mahachunda, after exhorting the monk Channa, they got up from their seats and went away. And then soon after they had left, the text says, the Venerable Channa used the knife. Okay. Now the commentary gives us some interesting account. This is in the note on the note 1311. The commentary says, he cut his throat, that's the jugular vein, and just at that moment, the fear of death descended on him, and then the sign of future rebirth appeared. This is called the gati nimitta. This is an abhidhammic term, which means that when the death process is occurring, they will occur to the mind within the death process. It can be either the sign of some karma that one has performed, or else the sign of a future destiny, or else the image of some object associated with the karma that one has performed that's going to determine the next rebirth. In this case, it's said to be the gati nimitta, the sign of a future rebirth. Okay, so then recognizing that he was still an ordinary person, let's say Putujana, a worldling, a common person, Channa became aroused, and then he developed insight, and then comprehending the sankharas, the conditioned phenomena, he attained arhatship just before he expired. So this is from the commentary. And, you know, sometimes I have to raise the question, how does the commentator know that? You know, there's nothing like that is said in the sutta itself, and it seems important enough that if this were the case, it would be said in the sutta. And one might say, okay, it comes down through oral tradition, but then I raise the question, where did that oral tradition originate? If it Sariputta and Mahachunda weren't present when he committed suicide, and one might say, okay, the Buddha used his super knowledge to see what was going on in Channa's mind. In that case, then the Buddha should have explained what happened in the sutta. So it seems to me that, again, my opinion, that the commentaries, and this is probably going back to the old commentaries, were perplexed at the idea of an arhat taking his life, and so they had to find some way to explain that. But I think if we just stick to the text of the sutta, as we'll see, that it seems to be confirming that Channa, at least at the time that he used the knife, was an arhat. Okay, so soon after they had gone, the Venerable Channa used the knife. Okay, then Sariputta goes to the Buddha. They've been living on Mount Vulture's Peak, which is a tall mountain. They're all outside of Rajagaha, and the Buddha is staying in the bamboo grove, which is on the plain. So Sariputta has to come down from Vulture's Peak, and he goes to the Buddha, and then he says to the Blessed One, Bhante, the Venerable Channa has used the knife. What is his destination? What is his future course? So from this question, obviously, Sariputta didn't use his super knowledge to see what was going on in Channa's mind during his death process, because Sariputta still thinks that Channa died as a non-arahat. So he's asking, what was his realm of rebirth? And now, this is the interesting thing. The Buddha doesn't reply with the words of the commentary. He doesn't say, well, when Channa used the knife, he was still a worldling, but in the course of the death process, he aroused fear because of the sign of rebirth, contemplated the formations as impermanent, and reached arhatship before his death. But the Buddha just confirms the original statement of the monk Channa. He says, didn't the monk Channa declare to you his blamelessness? Yeah, I express my own opinion in the note itself. I say that it should be imposed that the commentarial interpretation is imposed on the text from the outside, as it were. But if one sticks to the actual wording of the text, it seems that Channa was already an arhat when he made his declaration, and the dramatic punch is the failure of his two brother monks to recognize this. Okay, so from the Buddha's statement, it seems pretty clear, at least to me, that at the time Channa used the knife, took his own life, he was already an arhat. Okay, when the Buddha says this, then Sariputta immediately accepts it, and then he says that there is a Vajjayan village called Pubajira. The name of the village actually is a little bit different in different editions, and there's a version, the parallel version of the sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya in the section on the six sense bases, in which the name of the village is still different, doesn't mean anything. There, the Venerable Channa had friendly families, intimate families, approachable families. Then I must have added in brackets, or maybe Nyanamoli did, as his supporters. Okay, now there's a wordplay here, which it seems a little strange to me that there should be a wordplay in a situation like this. But there's a wordplay that comes out in Pali based upon what's called a homonym, a word in Pali that's the same, it's the same word in Pali. Well, let's say two words with different meanings which come to be the same word in Pali. If we represent them in Sanskrit, they come out to be two different words. So the word in Pali is Yeah, there's one word, upavadya. This is in Sanskrit, upavadya, which would mean blameable, blameworthy, and is based on the verbal root vad, which means to speak. So this is when one speaks critically about somebody, it's upavadati. One criticizes or blames somebody. And then the participle form of to be blamed or blameworthy is upavajja. But there's another word in Sanskrit, upavrajya, based upon the verbal root vraj, which means to go to. And so upavrajati would mean to approach. And upavrajya would mean to be approached. So it seems that the appropriate sense would be that these are friendly families, intimate families, families to be approached and to be informed. But the Pali word comes out upavajja, which sort of connects to the word upavajja in the earlier description of chana, as being anupavajja, blameless in the use of the knife. Okay, so that this merging of the two meanings explains the Buddha's reply. The Buddha says, indeed, Sariputta, the monk Channa had friendly families, intimate families, approachable families. And it seems that by using the word upavajja, upavajjani kulani, in relation to those families, Sariputta is, or at least the text is suggesting, that there might have been some inappropriate relations between Channa and these families, that Channa was getting too intimate with these families. And so this explains what the Buddha says next. He says, but I do not say to this extent he was blameworthy. Like, that is the wordplay between approachable as a description of the families, upavajja, upavajjani kulani, and chana as being unupavajja, not blameworthy, not blameable. Okay, then the Buddha makes this statement to Sariputta. He says, when one lays down this body and takes up a new body, then I say one is blameworthy. And this is sort of a generalization applying not only in the case of one who takes his own life, but anybody who, in laying aside this body with death, moves on as a result of ignorance, craving, and clinging, moves on to a new existence and takes up a new body, comes into a new existence, to that extent one is blameworthy because one hasn't eliminated the defilements that are responsible for generating a new existence. And then the Buddha continues, this did not happen in the case of the Bhikkhu Channa. The Bhikkhu Channa used the knife blamelessly. Okay, then I have the note to this and the note says, this statement seems to imply that Channa was an arhat at the time he committed suicide, even though the commentary explains otherwise. Okay, so this is what the Blessed One with the Buddha said. Then the Venerable Sariputta was satisfied and he delighted in the Buddha's words. Okay, and that takes us through the Channa Sutta. Any questions or comments? Yes, please. Yeah. There's this mobile microphone. Please use that.
Can I comment on on the blameless part?
Yeah.
If you're not observing.
Yeah.
The attainment.
If you're not observing the precepts purely, you're not going to reach. Of course, observing the precepts purely is a precondition, but more than just observing the precepts is necessary to reach arhatship. Oh, that was a breach of the precept. This is where I have a different opinion. Of course, in the abstract, the precept says, panati pata veramani sikapadang. So one undertakes the training rule to abstain from the destruction of life. Okay. And then for a monk, there's a graver precept, which is one is not to take a human life either directly or by encouraging another to take his own life, or by providing the instruments for somebody to take his own life. Okay, but I understand that this applies to other beings. It doesn't apply to oneself. And now in the case of a human being, a person, who is inclined to suicide because of emotional distress, agitation, and so forth, definitely in that case, you know, we would have to say one should not commit suicide. One has to learn to overcome this stress and this mental agitation and emotional dejection and so on. But I take the precept to abstain from the destruction of life to be based on the principle that all beings seek, want to live, not to die, want to be happy, not to suffer. Now, in the case of somebody who's reached arhatship and is afflicted with an extremely painful disease, apparently Channa has taken a variety of medicines. Probably they took him to see an acupuncturist. The acupuncture didn't work. They took him to see, he wouldn't have tried Western medicine, but they would have taken him to, given him the Ayurvedic Indian medicine, maybe burned, they call this moksha on him, given him every type of treatment, Reiki treatment, everything. Nothing worked. He had this, it must have been an extremely afflictive illness, constant, uninterrupted, from his description, like a man, a butcher cutting the belly of an ox, like his strong men roasting him over a pit. You know, constant, uninterrupted pain. And the alternative is either to endure that or to sever the life faculty and to enter into the ineffable, everlasting, imperturbable, perfect bliss of the Nibbana element with no residue remaining. And so for him, the choice was a clear one. That's my understanding. And please don't take this in any way if you're feeling anybody here gets dejected, depressed, or has some mental conflict. Please don't take me to be suggesting suicide. I'm just saying that in the case of an arhat who has this constant afflictive illness, as the Buddha says, the use of the knife is blameless. Barbara. Yeah, this is quite a different case. Let's take the case of Vietnam, the monks in Vietnam. This was not a case, first, where they were in any way claiming to be arhatships or thought themselves to be arhat, and not a case where they were suffering from an extremely oppressive illness, but they were suffering from an extremely oppressive condition. This also applies to Tibet, but particularly in Vietnam. I know in 1963, because my first Buddhist teacher was a Vietnamese monk who was involved on the inside of those events, that the government of Vietnam at that time, that was the government of Ngo Dinh Diem, he was a staunch Roman Catholic who wanted to impose Catholicism on the whole country. And so he prohibited the Buddhists from observing their traditional, especially the traditional holidays. He cut off, the Buddhists had a radio station where they presented, you know, Buddhist teachings. He prohibited that. He prohibited, I think, Dhamma lectures by the monks in the temples. And so the Buddhists had no way to communicate, and he cut off all communication between the Buddhists and the outside world, so they had no way to convey their message to the outside world. So this was the way the first monk who did this, I mean, he was a meditating monk, not one who was really politically involved, but he thought that the only way we could convey this message to the outside world of the way Buddhism is being persecuted here is by some dramatic event. And so he decided then to take his own life. In fact, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, using a knife to cut his throat, but you know the image of sitting in the fire. And if you've seen that image, you see he remains sitting in meditative samadhi right while the flame is engulfing him. In Tibet, I know they've taken their, that monks have taken their life. I don't know whether they were actually sitting immobile within the flames. Yes. Yeah, it's good if you take the mobile microphone so it gets into the recording.
I had a question about these two Pali roots that you mentioned here, these two Sanskrit roots.
Yeah.
So with the second one, I was under the impression that when we have a double consonant in the Sanskrit root, that double consonant would still be preserved when we add the Pali prefix. So, like, I might be totally wrong here, which is why I'm asking.
Yeah.
What I would expect then is that the VR would become a VV, which then goes to BB, but we would still see that double consonant. So instead of upavajja, we would see upavajja. So
I think maybe that would be expected, but it seems that the pun came through here within the way the text was preserved.
So do we see upavajja used in that sense of approachable elsewhere in the suttas?
I'd have to look into the to do a search for that.
Okay.
Wait, I'm just coming to mind in reply to his question. It's a word that means avoid. Yeah, I'll have to check that. I'm pretty sure that there is an example of that where you just get the V without the doubling of the consonant.
Yes, my question is, wouldn't the overwhelming desire to end pain be a craving?
You know, that's a question that I've pondered on. And the conclusion I would come in the case of an arhat, that it wouldn't be a form of craving, that there is just this overwhelming pain, and one considers that it's not necessary to endure it, and that there is that alternative. Again, please don't take this in any way as an encouragement to suicide. It's just that the sutta seems to be recognizing that possibility. Did somebody else have? Yeah. Your name again? It's
Manu.
Manu, yes.
There's a commentary, I'm just making reference to, I think, 1309, where it says that Mahachunda gave him this instruction, thinking he must still be an ordinary person, since he could not endure the deadly pains and wanted to commit suicide. So would you disagree with that based on what you said previously?
I think I would disagree. Let's say I'm not in a position to disagree, but I would raise a question about the commentarial explanation rather than the commentarial explanation of what Mahachunda was thinking. Because I would think that Mahachunda could have understood the implications of Channa's answers to Sariputta's questions correctly, that Mahachunda could have thought Channa indeed has answered accurately. He must be either stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, but not yet an arhat. So I'm going to give him this exhortation as a kind of to support him as he goes into the death process. You know, so it's not, in other words, where the commentary is saying that Mahachunda thought that Channa was a worldling, an ordinary person. I think it's possible that Mahachunda thought that Channa was a seka, one in the training, but not yet an arhat. Further questions? Okay, I said that we would try to, last week, I said we would try to cover two discourses in today's class. So now we'll go on to the next sutta. This is short and fairly simple. Well, actually, though, it's not so short, but there's a repetitive pattern. Okay, so this sutta concerns a different monk by the name of Puna. And according to the commentary background explanation, Puna had been a merchant from the west of India, from the region called Sunaparanta, which corresponds roughly to the area where today Mumbai or Bombay is located. And then he was a merchant, a traveling merchant. And so when he came to Savatthi, he heard the Buddha preach, and by hearing the Buddha's discourses, he decided to become a monk. Okay, so now Puna comes to the Buddha and requests the Buddha to give him what's called brief advice or brief instruction in order that he might go off into seclusion and meditate on it. Okay, so then the Buddha gives him the instruction that there are forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. If a bhikkhu delights in them, welcomes them, and remains holding to them, then delight arises in him. Then with the arising of delight, there is the arising of dukkha, I say. So this, in a way, it's a very we could say, a very concise statement of the relationship between the second and the first noble truths. Here, by the word delight, is not meant the ordinary pleasure that we think of. Or actually, it, in a sense, it does cover the pleasure that we think of. But nandi is expressed or understood as the delight that is associated with craving. And so in the Second Noble Truth, we have what is the Second Noble Truth? It's that tanha, which is nandi raga sahagata. That is, it's craving that is connected with, associated with nandi, delight, and raga, lust or passion. So the way I would understand it, when one has craving for what one doesn't possess, that is raga, and when one sort of delights in the things that one does possess, that is nandi. And so underlying that delight, there is this clinging or holding to the objects of pleasure. Okay, so then the Buddha repeats this for each of the six other five sense bases. And then he draws the conclusion with the arising of this delight. There is the arising of dukkha. So this is or covers the second and first noble truths. Then in the next passage, the Buddha covers, you could say, the third and fourth noble truths. So he says there are forms cognizable by the eye and so forth. If a bhikkhu does not delight in them, welcome them, and remain holding to them, delight ceases in him. With the cessation of delight, there is the cessation of dukkha, I say. So here we could say that not delighting, not welcoming, not holding is in a sense a summation of the path. And then the ceasing of delight, well, let's say the ceasing of dukkha that occurs with the ceasing of, well, let's say, okay, when the path is brought to its consummation, then that's accompanying the craving, that ceases. So that's the consummation of the path. And then with the cessation of delight, there is the cessation of dukkha or suffering. That is the third noble truth. Okay, then the Buddha, somehow he must have known of Puna's intention, because he asks, after I've given you this brief exhortation, where will you dwell? And usually the Buddha doesn't ask this. Usually the monk just gets the advice or the instruction from the Buddha, and then he goes off someplace in seclusion. But now, in this case, Puna replies that now that you've given me this brief exhortation, I am going to dwell in the Sunaparanta country. And if we follow the commentary, that would have been his own native land. So then the Buddha says that the people of Sunaparanta are fierce and rough. If they abuse you and threaten you, what will you think then? And then Puna says, if the people of Sunaparanta abuse and threaten me, then I shall think that these people are excellent, truly excellent, in that they do not give me a blow with the fist. Okay, then the questions continue in a series. Okay, if they give you a blow with the fist, what will you think? Then I'll think that they're truly excellent because they do not give me a blow with a clod. Back in ancient India, that would have been maybe the worst type of weapon that people had. Or a clod, or the next one is a stick. Well, actually, it gets worse as we go on, and that they do not give me a blow with a knife. Okay, if they give you a blow with a knife, what will you think? That they're truly excellent, that they have not taken my life with a sharp knife. Then I will think thus, blessed one. Okay, then the Buddha says, if the people of Sunaparanta take your life with a sharp knife, what will you think then? Okay, then Puna says, if they take my life with a sharp knife, then I will think that there have been disciples of the Blessed One who, being repelled, humiliated, and disgusted by the body and by life, have sought an assailant, somebody to take their life. But I have obtained this assailant without even seeking one. I shall think thus. Okay, then the Buddha commends him and says, good, good, Puna, possessing such self-control and peacefulness or gentleness, you will be able to dwell in the Sunaparanta country. Now you may go at your convenience. And when Puna makes that statement about the disciples of the Buddha who have sought an assailant, he may be referring to an incident that's referred to. It's a rather strange incident that's mentioned in the Samyutta Nikaya in the discourses on mindfulness of breathing. And again, it's mentioned in the Vinaya under the rule against taking a human life. According to this account, the Buddha taught the monks the meditation, which is called the meditation on the impure nature of the body, on the 32 or 31 parts of the body, you know, hair, what's in the body, the hairs of the head, nails, teeth, skin, and so forth, which is often recommended as the antidote to sensual desire. Okay, immediately after teaching that, the Buddha goes into retreat for, is it 2 weeks or 3 months? Okay, so the Buddha's in retreat, and then the monks are doing this meditation, apparently unguided, and then they become repelled by the body. And then some of them take each other's life. Well, one takes, they can't take each other's life because when one dies. Or they take the lives of other monks, or they seek somebody. There's somebody called a pseudo ascetic who they persuade to take their life. And then at the end of the Buddha's retreat, he comes out and he looks at the Sangha. And he sees so many monks are missing. And then he asks Ananda, where have all of those monks gone? Then Ananda explains to him what's taken place while the Buddha was on retreat. And then the Buddha says, well, in that case, I'll teach you another meditation subject, which is peaceful and excellent and so forth. And then he teaches mindfulness of breathing. And I find that whole incident rather strange because one would think, you know, the Buddha, as a master, one who knows the minds of others, would know the minds of the people that he's teaching, would know that if I'm going to teach them this mindfulness on the parts of the body, then I should be around to guide them if they encounter problems. And not only this in the sutta, the Buddha's in retreat, but then the question comes to my mind, where is Sariputta? Where is Moggallana? Where is Ananda? Where is Mahakachayana, Anuruddha? You know, it seems like just a bunch of novices have been taught this meditation subject and no senior monks are around. So it's rather strange. In any case, that is what happened, that the monks, some monks took the life of other monks, and then they had other monks take their life, and then some went to this outside ascetic and asked him to take their lives, and that led up to the Buddha proclaiming this rule and teaching mindfulness of breathing as a meditation subject. Okay, so then Puna, after paying homage to the Buddha, he gets up and he takes his belongings and he goes off to the Suna Paranta country. And then during the first rains retreat that he spends there, it says that he established 500 male lay followers and 500 women lay followers in the practice. And he himself realized the three, I would call the three vijas, the three clear knowledges or higher knowledges. So at the time he left, certainly he wasn't yet an arhat, but within this period, he realized first the recollection of past, his own past lives. Then he developed a divine eye by which he could see other beings passing away and taking rebirth. And finally, he realized the destruction of the asavas, the attainment of full liberation. And then this sutta just tells us on a later occasion, the Venerable Puna attained final nibbana. But again, this sutta has a parallel in the Samyutta Nikaya, which says that during that same rains retreat, the Venerable Puna attained parinibbana, attained final nibbana. So sometimes you could see that in the course of oral transmission of a text amongst different reciters, sometimes little differences come in. Okay, then word must have spread from Suna Paranta country in the west through a chain of transmission, come to the Buddha, who's in the eastern part of India. And so a number of monks hear this and they go to the Buddha and they tell him that that monk Puna, to whom you gave an exhortation, has passed away. What is his destination? What is his future course? This was the same question that Sariputta had asked about the monk Channa. And then the Buddha says that the clansman Puna was wise. He practiced in accordance with the Dhamma and did not trouble me. I think a better rendering would be, he did not trouble me about matters pertaining to the Dhamma. Then the Buddha announces that the clansman Puna has attained final nibbana. Okay, and that concludes the discourse. It seems that these two suttas were placed close by, the Channa Sutta and the Puna Sutta. Well, for one thing, they're both included in this particular chapter because the overriding theme of the chapter are the six sense bases. But the two suttas have something in common, that they both deal with a monk who dies prematurely. In one case, through his own hand, in the case of Puna. Here, there's nothing said about him dying from unnatural causes, but I think in some other texts, maybe from other schools that have the same story, I think it might have been said that Puna had been killed by the people of Suna Paranta. This I'm not sure about. Okay, any questions now about this sutta? The sutta is self-explanatory. Okay, if there's no questions now, you could give a little thought to the to these two suttas, and then we'll come back. Let's say 12:30, then we could have about half an hour of discussion. Okay, so we end with the sharing of the merits. So we share the merits with the Dhamma-protecting devas, the Nagas, or the dragon spirits, the Buddhas, the fierce spirits, asking them to protect the Dhamma, to protect the world, to protect ourselves. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Eta vatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Eta vatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Eta vatacham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhavagupadaya avici hetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibutin. Okay, so we end with three half bows to the Buddha. Couldn't find the chime this morning. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Okay, one, two, three.